Idols. In the Old Testament, God is angry a lot. He keeps trying to be a special friend to the Jewish people, and over again they do something that hurts him so much and makes him so angry, he has a temper tantrum and threatens to break up with them, to call them not my people. Growing up, I knew that this something that Israel repeatedly did was almost always something called idolatry, cheating on God. This is why couples break up, infidelity. And as I've said, we were taught what my church felt the modern equivalents of idols were.
Oh, there's no one here that would bow down to Buddha. There's no one here who would be deceived by the multiple idols of Hinduism. There's no one here who would have anything to do with the Juju gods of Africa. But, beloved young people, I want to ask you a question. Are you happy? Are you happy? If not, I believe the answer lies in this. You, I, somewhere, have accumulated some idols concerning which this verse would solemnly warn us.
Anything that took one away from God and meeting in terms of time or affection. So, television, movies, dancing, sports, whatever, stuff that you loved and which you were willing to give affection and time to, the latter of which only God deserves. Those were idols, if you liked them much anyway. Jake tells me that when he was 10, he felt his heart exercised in a very Christian way about an idol he felt he had to give up for God.
SpongeBob SquarePants.
Jake liked SpongeBob too much. SpongeBob gave Jake too much joy. Loving SpongeBob was taking love away from God. About her husband, Tim, who is still very much under the influence of a brethren mindset, Louisa writes,
"My husband struggles with this, as he finds great enjoyment and challenge in planning, building, and flying model airplanes. He struggles with if this is merely a worldly pastime that will all be burned up, his part in it, not just the layout itself. I've been encouraged by the grace a couple of meeting brothers in Meeting B have been towards Tim, even told him directly to not burn them all when he has felt like he should. Some of this is a black and white frame of mind, and some of it is legalistic comments he hears at conferences."
We heard about idols so much, but there was no thought that idolatry could be building up a religious system and worshiping it rather than God. Building a tower to heaven made of a pile of bricks and stained glass, or a pile of dusty books, or a group of guys, or a set of political positions, or a pile of doctrines, and substituting that man-made stuff for a relationship with God himself, calling that man-made stuff God, if anyone questioned it. Because you can raise money and put an addition on a pile of bricks and stained glass. Because you can dust off your dusty books and tell other people to read them. Because you can phone guys in a group. You can trumpet your political positions to the skies shamelessly on social media. You can make up doctrine and write it down. And you can agree to kick people out for saying anything that sounds different from your doctrine. You can define and control an idol you make yourself. Because you decide everything about the interaction. It's not like that with God. With God, you're not in the driver's seat. On my blog years ago, I came up with a test for Christians who might be, I thought, exhibiting signs of being idolatrous about their religion. Idolatry test. Idolatry is having a perfectly good God who is a person, not only an authority figure or moral standard, to worship and have a relationship with, but instead choosing to invent extra crap to focus upon rather than him, codified rules, a specific lifestyle, etc. If you are an idolater, you have chosen to block God out of your life with something else. He hates that worse than a wife who finds a blow-up doll in her husband's closet. You might be an idolater if you think it's something akin to blasphemy for anyone but you and people you respect to criticize the church you are associated with. Everybody else is an infidel unbeliever who can't possibly understand and should just be quiet. Everyone who is anything less than supportive is an enemy, a potential threat. You might be an idolater if you attend church, so people will know you are spiritually okay, and if you don't, will assume you definitely aren't. You attend church not as a natural outflowing of your love for God, but to try to get or maintain some appearance of spirituality by the act of dutiful, regular attendance. You might be an idolater if you collectively come together to worship the fact that you collectively come together to worship the fact that you collectively come together to worship. You come together to sing about coming together to sing about coming together to sing about coming together to sing. You might be an idolater if you feel unsafe without a human-built power structure within which to approach God. A lot of time is being spent by your church folk each week wrestling over matters of power, control, and authority. You worship the church rather than worship in the church. You might be an idolater if you are willing to alter many parts of your life, habits, dress, and time on a daily basis for no other reason than to accommodate the expectations of people in your church, whatever their reasons may be. You serve expectation. You serve impression and image. You might be an idolater if your solution to different people is to feel they'd be happier somewhere else because they don't fit and you don't feel inclined to accommodate them. Rather than make the structure accommodate people who could be helped by it, you treat with suspicion any people who say they aren't being helped by it in its current form. You might be an idolater if a person's increasing failure to regularly attend church means you think, feel, and act almost as if they were dead, or some kind of traitor or deserter. You have no real belief in anyone spending 40 days in the backside of the desert, in any form of solitude. They need to report Sunday morning and get singing. You might be an idolater if you aren't willing to seek out your own God-given answers to your own God-given problems, but badly want to be told what to do by others. You deal with the church rather than with God. You might be an idolater if you've built a lovely castle of shoulds that you will neither stop feeling guilty about not achieving, nor achieve. Contemplating this castle you've built makes you much happier than the thought of looking at anything real. You focus upon a self who isn't a real thing and will never be one, and act like only that self deserves the acceptance of God or the church, the latter being more important to you. You might be an idolater if you don't know how to feel good about your lifestyle choices unless people at your church feel okay about them. Anything they don't understand is something you are tempted to avoid for their sake. You might be an idolater if you hope that God will bless you based upon what you put into the church and what you sacrifice for it. When you don't benefit from church, don't learn anything at church, or are actually hurt by your church, you assume that the problem must lie with you on some level. If you behaved as you should, it would work. You might be an idolater if you found out for certain there were actually no God, your Sunday routine would scarcely be altered by this fact at all. You'd still show up and sing the songs. Pleasure. Rules seem to exist to try to control pleasure mostly, don't they? People kept telling me that they read The Shack and that it meant a whole lot to them. So I read it. The local Christian bookstore was refusing to stock it, so I bought it at the supermarket. That made me think right there. The Shack is actually a pretty shallow and crappily written book, I think. Yet the embarrassing fact for many of us who have read various books with far deeper and more elegantly told stories or topics is that many of us kinda needed The Shack, or at least benefited from it greatly. And maybe that's a bit pathetic, that we got into such a state that we needed The Shack to lay hold on something that should have been so simple and so widely grasped.
God likes us to enjoy ourselves in healthy, appropriate ways, because he loves us like a mother or father does. He likes us to be happy and enjoy ourselves. He likes us to appreciate and love good things, even good things like food and friendship, song and fun.
In his stand-up comedy, Irish comedian Dylan Moran swearingly says that we need a healthy relationship with pleasure. Amusingly and vulgarly arguing that people across the world hate the French because of their unthinkingly accepting approach to pleasure, starting with chocolate bread in the morning and spiraling downhill throughout the day from there. Moran believes that there's something unhealthy and bizarre in us feeling guilt every time we feel desire or pleasure. Dylan Moran was raised Catholic. He talks about how some people, Protestants for instance, can walk into a room, he thinks, and casually see a plate of cookies and eat one and enjoy it. But others, raised like him, see the plate and say, As soon as no one's looking, I just know I'm going to walk over and eat every single one. Oh, I'm walking over. The shame, the shame, the shame. I'm eating them. I can't tell which is nicer, the biscuits or the shame. Nothing could make the shame go away but cocaine. I agree with Dylan Moran that we need to ensure we have a healthy relationship with pleasure. I think anything else makes the Bible, written to people who did not bear the imprint of Puritan upbringing that we do, not work right. Nowadays, it can be used to make worse people filled with pieces of exaggerated, sort of biblical advice that are already being taken too far in the legalistic direction. That Bible verses written to lawless people are being used to shove legalism at everybody. And that going farther in that legalistic direction will not remotely resemble wisdom. If you're a husband and the Bible tells you to love your wife as you love your own body, for her sake, I hope you have a healthy attitude to your own body. One troubling epiphany of mine was to eventually come to the harsh realization that we weren't worshiping the God of the New Testament at all. We worshiped a pagan, pleasure-hating idol with a whole pre-Christian system of sacrifice around it, with an altar upon which we could offer daily sacrifices of what would otherwise have been fun for us. So some of us needed to read The Shack, that Nancy Drew fan fiction written on ecstasy and cheap wine work that basically has that one extremely already fully conveyed in scripture but somehow missed by apparently all of us point. God likes you. Period. He wants you to be happy. Stick with him and he will give you the desires of your heart. Not just his heart, yours. Really. He's not out to get you. He's not vigilant to catch you enjoying too much pleasure. It's going to be a ride. Strap in. There will be scary bits, but it's going to be amazing. He calls it life. Love will be piped into the cabin throughout the journey, and laughter will be served. Apparently, there are really no substitutes for all of that. Nothing's as good. Not even abstinences and feeling more righteous than the person in the plane next to you. And none of it will need to be paid for in the dubious coin of self or church-inflicted shame.